All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're going to be jumping headfirst into a partnership law case. And this one is really important for anyone out there studying partnership law. So especially for all you law students out there, listen closely.
Definitely a case worth knowing.
It's J&J Cellcom v. AT&T Wireless Services. And this was decided back in 2007 and really gets at the heart of how RUPA, the Revised Uniform Partnership Act,
RUPA.
How RUPA deals with that duty of loyalty that partners owe to each other. And this is especially interesting when we're thinking about controlling partners and the actions they take that impact minority partners. So our mission today is to really break down this decision, see how it works, and understand what it means for how partners, how they should be interacting with each other.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. The really interesting thing about this case is that tension, right? You've got the freedom of contract. Mm. Partners can set up their relationships however they want in the agreement.
Right.
But at the same time, you've got these fiduciary duties that are just there. They exist no matter what the contract says.
Right, right.
And so this case really makes us think about that line. When does a powerful partner, even if they're doing things that seem to be allowed, when do they cross the line and violate those basic duties that they have?
Okay, so let's set the stage here, paint a picture of what's going on. We've got 9 different regional cellular partnerships.
Okay.
And in each of these, AT&T Wireless Services, AWS, they've got this huge stake, over 95% ownership in each.
Wow, they're the big guy.
Yeah, they're the controlling partner, right? And then on the other side, you've got these minority partners, and that includes our plaintiff here, J&J Cellcom.
Okay.
Much smaller shares, right?
Mm-hmm.
And AWS, they were the ones calling the shots, managing all the day-to-day stuff, making decisions.
Makes sense. So they're in control, and then they decide they want to streamline things.
Exactly. Cut some costs, make it simpler, and their solution was to buy out all those minority partners.
Interesting. So how did they go about doing that?
Well, they put together a buyout offer for the minority partners, right?
Okay, so price.
Yeah. And the price they offered was a little bit above what a third-party appraiser had come up with.
Oh, so they got an independent valuation?
Yeah, at least for some of the partnerships. Mm-hmm. But, and here's where things get interesting and maybe a little controversial.
I'm sensing some drama.
Yeah, this wasn't just a friendly, hey, here's an offer.
Right.
They basically said, take it or leave it.
An ultimatum.
Yeah, like, take this buyout at this price, or we are going to sell all these partnership assets to one of our own affiliates. And we can do that because we have the majority vote, right? Mm-hmm. Or we're going to sell it at that same appraised value. And then we're just going to dissolve the partnerships. You get whatever your little share of the proceeds is. Goodbye.
Wow. So it's do it our way or else. That's pretty aggressive.
Yeah. And some of those minority partners, they were like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Take the money and run. But others, including J&J Cellcom, they were like, no, this is not right. We're going to sue.
That takes us right to the legal battle, right?
Yeah.
So the big question that eventually goes all the way up to the Washington Supreme Court,
right,
is whether AWS doing this, using their power this way,
right,
did they breach their fiduciary duty, specifically the duty of loyalty that they had to those minority partners?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Now, the lawsuit actually had some other claims in it, too, breach of contract and things like that. But it's that duty of loyalty question under RUPA that becomes, that really becomes the central issue, the big one.
Yeah, the lower courts, they mostly sided with AWS.
Oh, really?
They said, yeah, you're acting within your rights here. But this question of, can you use this majority-approved sale to basically force a buyout at a price you set? Does that violate the duty of loyalty? That became a big enough legal question that it went all the way up to the Washington Supreme Court.
It got kicked upstairs.
Oh, yeah. So now the Washington Supreme Court, they had to answer this question.
Yeah.
Did what AWS did, even if it was technically allowed under the partnership agreement, did it violate that core duty of loyalty that they owed to their minority partners? That's the big question.
What'd they say? What did the Supreme Court say?
They said no.
Oh, wow.
They said no. AWS did not breach its duty of loyalty. And this is a huge takeaway here for you law students listening. The court basically said that if a deal like this follows the rules of the partnership agreement,
right,
if it's done in good faith and the price is fair, then generally it's not going to be seen as a breach of that duty of loyalty. And this is even true, and this is important, even when you have a self-dealing situation.
Self-dealing meaning?
Meaning the controlling partner, they're acting in a way that benefits themselves, maybe even at the expense of the partnership. Hmm. In this case, selling to their own affiliate.
Right, 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 right.
So it's interesting because the partnership agreement didn't specifically talk about sales to affiliates, right? But the court didn't see that as a deal breaker. They were looking at the bigger picture. So let's get into their reasoning here. What were the things that they looked at that led them to say, no, AWS, you're in the clear?
Well, you can't overstate the importance of the partnership agreement itself.
Yeah.
As we said, this agreement very clearly allowed the sale of partnership assets, you know, if the majority voted for it.
Right.
And RUPA, which is the law that we're talking about here, RUPA really puts a lot of emphasis on the idea that partners can change, they can modify a lot of those default, those standard fiduciary duties if they agree to something different in their partnership agreement.
Right. So as long as AWS followed the procedure that the agreement laid out.
Exactly.
They were good.
Yeah, that was a really, really big point in their favor.
So it's like RUPA saying, hey, we trust you guys to figure this out yourselves, write it down.
Right.
And we're going to stick to that.
Yeah, it's a very contract-focused approach, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just about checking the boxes in the agreement, right?
Right.
It seems like fairness was a big deal for the court, too.
Oh, absolutely. The court, they dug deep into how fair this whole deal was. And there were a few things that stood out to them. First, AWS, they were totally upfront with the minority partners. They told them everything about the sale. They didn't hide anything.
Full transparency.
Exactly. And remember, they had that third-party appraisal. Even if it wasn't used to value every partnership at the start, it still showed that they were trying to be objective about the price.
Right. An independent check, kind of.
Yeah. And in the end, the court said, look, AWS, they paid fair market value. Nothing in the evidence said that they were acting in bad faith or that they were trying to pull a fast one.
Okay, so that's a good point. And this is something I really want to emphasize for the listeners. One thing that seems super important here is this question of, you know, can you show that you were actually harmed, right? It seems like the minority partners, they had a hard time proving that they actually lost money because of this sale.
You're exactly right. The court said, look, you can't just say that you feel like something was wrong. You have to actually prove that you were financially worse off because of what happened.
So it's not enough to just say, that doesn't feel right.
Nope.
You got to show the damage, the financial impact.
Yeah, and for minority partners, that can be a really tough thing to do.
For sure, for sure. Now, we talked a bit about Justice Manson's concurring opinion earlier, and it's worth going back to that because it helps us understand this shift that RUPA made. Can you talk a bit more about the significance of that concurrence for understanding RUPA's approach here?
Yeah, definitely. So Justice Madsen's opinion really highlights the difference between RUPA and the old Uniform Partnership Act, what they call the UPA. The old UPA, it had a much stricter view of fiduciary duties. It was really protective of partners. But RUPA, it takes a different approach, much more contract focused, like we've been talking about. Justice Madsen basically said that RUPA gives partners more freedom to pursue their own interests as long as they're playing by the rules of the partnership agreement and being transparent about what they're doing.
So it's a shift away from the courts stepping in all the time to protect partners. It's saying, hey, you guys figured it out, write it down, and we'll respect that.
Exactly.
So let's bring this home for our law students out there.
If we had to boil this down into a checklist for a controlling partner,
right?
What are the things they need to keep in mind to avoid getting in trouble for breaching their duty of loyalty when they're doing a deal that benefits them under RUPA? What did we learn from J&J Selcom? All right, so based on what the court said in J&J Selcom, here are the key things to remember. First, you got to be totally open and honest with all the partners. Everyone needs to know what's going on. Full transparency is key.
Okay, so no secrets.
Exactly. Second, the price has got to be fair. And the best way to show that is to get an appraisal from a reputable third party. That's your proof.
That independent valuation, like we were talking about.
Exactly. Third, whatever you're doing, whether it's selling assets or something else, it's got to be allowed by the partnership agreement. And not just allowed, it has to be something that the majority can vote to approve, just like that asset sale provision we were talking about.
Right. Follow the rules you set.
Right. And finally, and this is super important, you can't take advantage of the minority partners. You can't be sneaky or try to force them into a bad deal.
Gotcha. So act in good faith.
Exactly. And in the J&J Selcom case, the court basically said that AWS did all these things. They checked all the boxes, so they were in the clear.
All right. So law students, let's talk about why this case matters to you. Why is understanding J&J Selcom so important for your studies and for your future as lawyers?
Well, first of all, this case is a perfect example of how much power RUPA gives to the partnership agreement. Like we've been saying, that agreement can basically override the default rules about fiduciary duties.
So it's not just about the law, it's about the contract.
Exactly. And that means that when you're drafting these agreements, you got to be super careful. You have to be really specific and cover everything, including any changes you want to make to those standard fiduciary duties.
So that's a huge lesson for anyone who might represent minority partners down the road, right?
Yeah.
Because this case shows that if the majority follows the agreed upon rules and they're somewhat fair about it, the courts might not step in just because the minority partner doesn't like the outcome.
That's
right. But doesn't that kind of put minority partners at a disadvantage? Especially if they don't have as much bargaining power when the agreement is being written.
Yeah.
Is there a limit to how much you can change those fiduciary duties in the agreement?
That's a great question. And while RUPA does focus on the contract, there are still some basic principles of fairness and good faith that you can't just get rid of completely.
Right.
But J&J Selcom definitely shows that minority partners need to be proactive. They need to negotiate for protections in that agreement from the very beginning. Things like requiring a supermajority vote for certain big decisions, especially those that involve potential conflicts of interest, like deals with affiliates.
So it's all about protecting yourself up front.
Right. You got to think ahead.
And what about for those who might be advising controlling partners? What's the takeaway for them?
For controlling partners, the message is pretty clear. Be transparent. Be fair and stick to the rules. Make sure you can prove that the price is right, ideally by getting an independent valuation. And always, always, always follow the procedures and the terms that are laid out in that partnership agreement. That's your best defense against accusations of breaching your fiduciary duties, especially in self-dealing situations.
So be prepared to show that you acted fairly and within the bounds of the agreement.
Exactly. Don't give anyone any reason to question your actions.
Okay, so the big takeaway here for anyone studying partnership law under RUPA is that the partnership agreement is king. That's what J&J Selcom really highlights. You got to start your analysis by looking closely at that agreement and remember what Justice Madsen said about that contractarian shift. And don't forget, if you're a minority partner and you're claiming a breach of fiduciary duty, you have the burden of proof. You have to show that you actually suffered financial harm.
Yeah, the court isn't going to just take your word for it. You got to have the evidence to back it up.
So it's not enough to say, that doesn't feel right. You got to show the financial impact.
Right. Feelings don't win lawsuits. Facts do.
That's a good way to put it. J&J Selcom is a really clear example of how RUPA tries to find that balance between the rights and obligations of partners. And a big part of that is respecting the agreements that they make with each other, as long as those agreements are fair and made in good faith.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, so just to wrap things up, J&J Selcom really drives home this idea that RUPA is all about the contract and that having a clear and comprehensive partnership agreement is absolutely essential for defining the fiduciary duties that partners owe to one another.
It all comes back to the agreement.
And that brings us to a final thought for our listeners to chew on. Given what we've learned about J&J Selcom, how do you think this decision might change the way partnership agreements are negotiated in different industries and business settings? What kinds of clauses do you think minority partners might start pushing for even harder after this case? It's something to really think about as you continue your legal studies.
Yeah.
Great food for thought.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive today. We'll be back next time with another fascinating case to explore.
Always a pleasure.
See you then.